And perhaps we really need to tackle this through understanding spirituality and motivate ourselves on a higher level and motivate the planet, each other. But we need to understand it better. What is spirituality? What do we want from it? What can it do for us? And to help us do that is the author of a wonderful book that I just read called The Presence of the Infinite. And I've interviewed the author before for a previous book. And so I'm so glad to have Steve McIntosh back on the show. Steve, welcome.
Thank you, Peter. It's a pleasure to be with you.
It's so wonderful to talk about this because we all want progress.
Yeah.
We need it.
Well, we feel a duty to try to make the world a better place while we're here in our brief lives.
Right. And so, and better place for the future lives of our families and friends and civilization.
Right. And indeed, making the world a better place is the surest route to our own self-actualization.
Right. And we're in a progressive period. But how much progress are we actually making? And maybe this progressive period needs to be enhanced in some ways that you tackle in your book.
Right. Well, we're certainly making progress, you know, in some ways too rapidly, and in other ways not fast enough. So ideally, we'd make the right kind of progress, which is progress in values.
Right, because it too rapidly might be too haphazard.
Well, and it might be unsustainable and cause a crash.
Yep, yep. So we want to understand the deeper impulse that we have to make progress. What is it that's driving us so that we can manage it better so that it can be sustained?
That's a good way of looking at it, yeah.
And so let's talk about spirituality, because that's how I introduced the show, that maybe we need to understand our spiritual nature in order to tackle these greater truths of life.
Sure. You know, I view spirituality through what's known as a hermeneutic circle, or a kind of a chain of understanding where one concept explains another. And I start with spiritual experience itself. You know, what is spiritual experience? How does one have it? What does it do for you? You know, what's the nature? What's the referent of the experience that you're having when sort of categorized as a spiritual experience?
So many people talk about spirituality nowadays. You know, they say, well, I'm not mm-hmm. so religious, but I'm spiritual. So
right.
What does that really mean?
Well, it means different things to different people. And what it mainly means is that I'm not a part of traditional or religious spirituality. You know, I don't go to church every Sunday, but I'm not an atheist. And so it's a way of distinguishing from the two major kinds of spirituality, or, you know, two of the three major kinds in America: religious spirituality, kind of secular aspirituality, and then progressive spirituality. The spiritual but not religious, I think, include people who have loyalties and affinities to progressive spirituality, but the category is much bigger than those who are involved in progressive spirituality per se. So I think it includes everybody else who doesn't ascribe to religious spirituality, but is nevertheless knows that there's more to the universe than matter in motion.
But that's what's important, is that what is it that they know? What is an ultimate reality that they're looking at that they ascribe to?
Well, and that's where there can be progress made. Now, I mentioned that the hermeneutic circle. I mean, connected to spiritual experience is both spiritual practice that can lead to that experience and spiritual teaching about what's really true and worthwhile, that both enhances experience and practice. And spiritual teaching is one of the areas where I think we can make significant progress, and that's one of the main themes of my book.
Right, and there are intrinsic values that the teaching will approach. It's just that we want to start out with understanding who we're speaking to or what we're speaking to in people, why they'd be interested in a deeper understanding. And I think what you talk about in the book is that our spirituality is really experiential, that we all have a sense of something deeper, something more infinite.
Well, I think that humans crave spiritual experience, whether they, you know, define it that way or not. And everybody has had a spiritual experience, whether they would label it that way or not. One of the other themes of the book is describing how, in the future, more functional forms of spirituality, whether they're individual or more cultural, the more that they deliver authentic spiritual experience, the more powerful they'll be for all the other benefits that spirituality can bring, like spiritual leadership and spiritual solidarity, even while we retain pluralism, you know, and different convictions of what ultimate reality stands for. I think we're at the brink of the emergence of a more effective kind of spirituality that retains pluralism, that better integrates science, and that transcends and partially includes the best of what's on offer in our various forms of spirituality, you know, in American culture today.
Right, and I think that's what's important, is that there is pluralism, there is the understanding of our history, and that a lot of people hold those values, and we're not saying to them, sorry, you have to give up your values, but, you know, let's look at ways that you can include new ideas into those traditional values.
Sure. In other words, part of the way, part of the method for evolving consciousness or persuading people to adopt wider, more inclusive views is to actually increase the scope of what they're able to value. We don't want people to change their values. We just want them to value in a wider horizon of values. And by doing so, they'll naturally find that their consciousness is raised and that they're more self-actualized in the process.
Right. And now, you're looking at including everybody because you're including spirituality, you're using spirituality in a way that includes not only traditional religions, but you also talk about secular spirituality. Let's look at that, because there are people who are hard to talk to about spirituality because they're too secular. And
sure.
What does that mean?
Yeah, well, thanks for bringing that up. I mean, in the book, I identify three basic kinds of spirituality that are on offer in American marketplace of ideas. And each one of these kinds of spirituality has highly developed, mature, and very interesting forms, and less mature, more crude or vulgar forms. So the three major kinds of spirituality are religious spirituality or traditional spirituality, which includes, obviously, churches, synagogues, mosques, temples, and that's what most people think of when they think of religion. Then there's progressive spirituality, which has emerged in the last 40 or 50 years primarily in places in the developed world, especially in America. This includes what we would think of as New Age, but it also includes westernized Buddhism and progressive versions of Advaita Vedanta Hinduism. And there's this whole kind of culture of progressive spirituality, which is still a kind of a counterculture, but it's probably about 15% of Americans have some kind of loyalties or affinities for progressive spirituality. And you can see it in popular authors such as Eckhart Tolle or, through the affinities of celebrities like Oprah or Madonna. I mean, progressive spirituality is a market, but it's not really taken seriously by the mainstream media or academia or the education establishment, so it remains somewhat countercultural, although it has vibrancy. But it's distinct. It's definitely, while there's some overlap, you can readily tell the difference culturally between progressive spirituality and religious spirituality. And then in the middle is a group of folks who are active non-believers, right? These are people who are
right.
Atheists or Marxists or existentialists or those who are clear in their self-identity and their understanding of reality, that there's no supernatural or transcendent dimension of the universe.
They're material fundamentalists.
Well, I mean, they're just like, for example, in religious spirituality, they're both fundamentalists and, liberal theologians who are thoroughly in touch with science and are not biblical literalists, right? There's good and bad, or, advanced or less so.
Right.
In one of these categories.
I've talked to the hard-nosed material fundamentalists who don't want to believe in anything.
Sure. There are certainly people who identify with this kind of secular physicalist worldview who are somewhat fundamentalist in their insistence that there can't be anything transcendent or the universe is simply an accident and that's all. But then there are also people in this category of what I call secular spirituality. You know, I call it a spirituality because it provides identity, defines what's real, what's true and worthwhile. It competes against other forms of spirituality. So it does the work of spirituality, whether you call it that or not. And this frame of reality that's secular has some very sophisticated proponents of it, religious naturalists, who recognize that there is sacred dimensions of the universe, even though there may not be any supernatural explanations therefore. Stuart Kaufman, for example, in his books, has tried to identify creativity as a sort of sacred dimension of the universe that is still in, you know, comports with a scientific materialistic worldview. So again, secular spirituality has become fashionable now, with people like Sam Harris and Christopher Hitchens regularly profiled in the New York Times or on the Charlie Rose television program. And so within the mainstream, within modernism, sort of this active, fierce non-belief, this rejection of spirituality of any kind, has gotten a lot of traction in the culture. And I think part of it is because of the failure of both religious spirituality on the one side and progressive spirituality on the other to really deliver the kind of spiritual leadership that can give our society a greater sense of solidarity.
All right, good. So now we have a lot of spirituality out there. And what I'm looking at is the intention of moving society forward. What is the underlying impulse of all humans in life? Their purpose in life is to do a better job, to get better, to succeed,
to fulfill
themselves. So,
well, the kind of spirituality that I advocate in my work is evolutionary spirituality, which is emerging out of progressive spirituality, but it's trying to make a break from the limitations, the extreme relativism, the magical thinking. The shortcomings of progressive spirituality are points of departure for evolutionary spirituality, which attempts to transcend and include the accomplishments of progressive, secular, and religious spirituality.
Right. So you want to use
that. I'm going to get to the evolutionary impulse here. One of the ways that evolutionary spirituality does that is by better integrating science and spirituality, by recognizing that evolution itself, what we can now see about evolution from the Big Bang 13.8 billion years ago to the evolution of matter, the evolution of life, the evolution of consciousness and culture, understood, interpreted appropriately, this biggest truth that humans can know, the truth of evolution, is not only a scientific boon for understanding physical reality, it's also a boon for understanding spiritual reality. There are spiritual teachings that go with what we now know about evolution. So it's sort of a natural form of spirituality that can supplement and enhance and complement other existing forms of spirituality. And one of the cornerstones of evolutionary spirituality is that in our human bodies, we embody thoroughly both the structure of evolution, you know, from the hydrogen atoms in our water molecules all the way up through all the stages of emergence that have led to us. And we also embody evolution's purpose in our purposes, what's known as the evolutionary impulse that begins with life. You know, the difference between living things and non-living things is that living things strive, survive, and reproduce.
A desire for continual advancement, continual refinement to make things
better.
Well,
the early forms of life are simply trying to survive and reproduce. And that striving, that intentionality within life is sort of prerequisite to the functioning of natural selection, right? As Lynn Margulis says, life is matter that chooses. And even if it's molecular and genetic and instinctual and pre-programmed, there's still a choice going on. There's still some spontaneity. And that
so we want to do everything to help that choice along.
Right. Well, that impulse we can feel. We can feel our own biological drives that we share with life. But the impulse in us goes beyond, for most of us at least, it goes beyond our biological impulses to survive and reproduce and be social and take care of our sort of basic needs in Maslow's hierarchy. Our impulse, when properly kindled and awakened, it's an impulse for the transcendent itself. It's an impulse for the beautiful, the true, and the good. The evolutionary impulse that makes us want to live up to our potential to want to grow spiritually, to want to make a contribution to the world, to want to be, you know, moral people, good parents, good friends, to want to create something beautiful or something true. Those noble, aspirational impulses that many humans feel allow us a direct phenomenological connection to the purpose of the universe itself. In other words, the universe's purposes are our purposes because we embody them, and we are agents of evolution. According to evolutionary spirituality, our golden opportunity is to try to contribute to the further perfection of the universe, and this evolutionary impulse is the guide, that still small voice inside of us that points the way, our moral compass, but not just the compass, but also it's not just, you know, light to see which way to go. It's also motivational power to put in the effort to try to grow spiritually and make the world a better place. And so understanding that this is a feature of the universe that we embody is a way of connecting this rather spiritual notion of striving for the beautiful, the true, and the good to the scientific notion of an evolving universe that starts with a Big Bang.
Yeah, these three intrinsic values really are they're not new. and people say, well, why aren't there more of them? Well, it's kind of a reduction of many words into these three foci, let's call it.
Right.
And it comes originally through Aristotle.
Well, actually, Plato
is credited
as the Greek philosopher who first sort of framed goodness in terms of beauty and truth. You know, the beautiful, the true, and the good are known as the Platonic triad, although you can't really find too much direct quotations of Plato. The Neoplatonists, and then building on Plato and Aristotle, geniuses like St. Thomas Aquinas really brought forward the beautiful, the true, and the good as important categories of spiritual philosophy. And they've continued to be championed by spiritual luminaries East and West. Alfred North Whitehead in the 20th century, Sri Aurobindo was known to identify the beautiful, the true, and the good as the three paths open for the seekers. And so there's something very special about the conceptual value triad, the philosophical understanding that intrinsic value is just like a good analogy is colors, right? The colors on our computer screen, RGB, red, green, blue, combine and contrast to produce practically all the colors in the human visual field. And so just as there are three primary colors, there are, in a sense, three primary values, and these word concepts, beauty, truth, and goodness, they stand as, in a sense, capstone qualities for entire dimensions of human experience, which we can identify as the moral, the rational, and the aesthetic. So, right. We're not just talking about beauty, truth, and goodness in naked form. We're talking about these dimensions of value and coming to understand that when we see things that are truly beautiful, true, and good, they have a gravity. They're impacting our evolutionary impulses. They have a magnetic quality that draws us. And the more we cultivate this spiritual impulse within us, the more we're able to find, and more importantly, make beauty, truth, and goodness in the world. So this philosophical idea is like a conceptual cathedral that's a form of philosophical high technology.
And people might question why the word love isn't included. And my response is that it's driven by love.
Sure. And so we could place love either below or above, you know, the triad in our little conceptual apparatus there. We could say that, well, you know, beauty, truth, and goodness are all forms of love or colors of love, if you will. But then we could also say that love is a species of goodness, you know, that love is the desire to do good to others, and that goodness is a higher concept than love because love can name something bad, right, or love can be misguided. But if something's truly good, then it's simply good, for all circumstances. Now, we could quibble about philosophical definitions, but the point of beauty, truth, and goodness spirituality, right, which is another name for evolutionary spirituality, is that it makes spirituality practical and it retains pluralism while being more philosophically sophisticated than sort of anything goes, you know, any form of spirituality is equally true. A lot of us, you see that a lot in progressive spirituality. And again, that's a step, it's evolutionarily appropriate to sort of let a thousand flowers bloom and allow for complete pluralism. But as I said before, you know, pushing beyond progressive spirituality shortcomings means retaining pluralism while bringing back some way, some measurement for what's more true and less true. Because, you know, truth itself is like a ladder of distinctions. And if we can't make any distinctions, we've effectively, you know, removed the power of truth from our spiritual understanding.
Right,
so
but it's
evolutionary
a place
spirituality
to start.
Brings truth back in a way that it's been right. temporarily bracketed within progressive spirituality.
So I think knowing these three concepts and embedding them in our purpose, just to ask ourselves every day, you know, how are we doing with truth, beauty, and goodness? and some people focus more on goodness, some people focus more on beauty, and some people focus more on truth. And we can also include them all each day and hold that in our own way. Of course, as you say, there are different truths and different beauties and different understandings of what's good and
right. And I, you know, I mean, sometimes I refer to them as the major food groups of spiritual nutrition. But one of the important things about these, spending some time thinking about these philosophical concepts and how they might relate to our lives, the practice of that is in recognizing that the beautiful, the true, and the good isn't just something we get. There's something that we can give. In other words, that the beautiful, the true, and the good as philosophical technology helps awaken us to the gift that we have to give, whatever our work in the world is, whatever, you know, we find to do to make money or, you know, occupy our time. There's a kernel in there of what we're doing that's beautiful, true, or good. You know, obviously all three, they're in a sense differentiated expressions of the same thing. But the way that they are differentiated helps us focus on, okay, if I'm in the service industry, for example, ultimately the spiritual experience, when I really get my job right, when I really make somebody feel good, when I'm really doing, you know, a service in whatever field I'm in, then there's actually a transmission of goodness, which is a kind of spiritual energy, which can be self-actualizing for me. You know, likewise, if I'm working in an aesthetic area, recognizing that this concept of beauty, even if what we're about aesthetically is not striving for beauty in a kind of a old-fashioned conception, but that there's a form of spiritual energy, a form of unity, that the best word is beauty. But within this aesthetic dimension of trying to bring the infinite into the finite, recognizing that there's something there that our minds can tune into and that our hearts can connect with, and bringing that kernel of spirit into our work, this concept of beauty or truth or goodness is really useful for focusing our mind and helping identify where that kernel lies and how we can bring more self-actualization into our work.
And we can actually look historically and see how we've evolved in these three aspects over time. You know, we live in a much more conscious environment now. Often, you know, the internet has a lot to do with it, and maybe that's part of the whole picture that we've created in order to help advance our consciousness. And the more we know,
yeah,
the more conscious we become. And we don't know how far we can take it, but we're trying to take it into new levels of truth, beauty, and goodness all the time. And so that's really what we're looking to do, is to infuse consciousness more with this purpose so that we can take advantage of it more.
Right. One of the more interesting features of this expanded philosophical understanding of these intrinsic values is that they show us how consciousness evolves. In a sense, even though we all live here in 2015, not everybody lives in the same time in history, right? The quote is that the future is here, it's just not evenly distributed. And when we understand that people make meaning and they orient their lives according to what might be called an octave of beauty, truth, and goodness. In other words, a particular bandwidth of values about what's true and what's beautiful and what's good. And that, in a sense, these value octaves are the worldview stages through which humanity has evolved. So you can see how we evolve in goodness, for example. At the tribal level, you know, those worthy of moral consideration are typically our blood kin. but then breaking out of that in larger religious civilizations, those worthy of moral consideration become everybody in our same religion. So we move from a kind of a kinship-based sense of morality to an ethnocentric-based sense of morality. Now, we look down on ethnocentric morality now, but at one point it was a major step beyond what was the prevailing conditions. Then there's a move to a more nation-centric sense of who's worthy of moral consideration, like all Americans are more worthy than, say, Chinese people, even though they may have different religions. And then eventually we move to another octave of beauty, truth, and goodness, where our conception of goodness embraces all sentient creatures, right? And everybody's in the world, all living things are worthy of our moral consideration. You know, and that's an example how the line of goodness itself evolves by steps within these different stages of consciousness that use these values to define their definition of what counts as improvement. In other words, humans have been trying to improve their conditions for the last 50,000 years at least. But what really counts for major improvement is when we improve our definition of improvement itself, when we move from one stage to another, and when we draw the circle of the beautiful, the true, and the good in a wider way. You know, truth is the same way. We move from a mythical understanding of reality to a more scientific understanding of reality, and now to a more holistic understanding of reality that's both scientific and spiritual, you know, when we get it right. And right. This is an example of how truth also evolves in stages, and that's why these values are not absolutistic, but they're not totally relative either. There is a direction of evolution in which we're getting it right, even though, you know, we're bringing in new problems and taking steps right. backward. I do argue strongly for some kind of progress.
Now, there's still a lot of resistance, and I think we will need to do another show about this, because we want to talk about what is it, what's the way that we can integrate so many differences in our world and move it forward. What are those differences, and how do they interact? What is their purpose that we can make good of it? And mm-hmm. so we want to, I think, do a second show really about the, let's call it the dialectic.
Great.
meaning the tension in the world that resists a lot of this collectivity rather than, you know, this tribal drive.
Sure. And those are pockets of energy which can be engines of evolution. Those forms of resistance. There's a way of seeing them for their what they're good for.
Right. So we're going to do that hopefully in the next week or two. Really would appreciate it, Steve. Thanks.
Okay.
So
my pleasure.
In the meantime, that people can run out and get The Presence of the Infinite. That's the name of your book, Steve McIntosh, McIntosh. Is there a website?
Yeah. My website is stevemcintosh.com. And if you just Google Steve McIntosh, I'm all over the first page there. And stevemcintosh.com has videos and excerpts from the book and lots of material there for people who are interested in this thinking.
Steve, thanks so much for being a guest on Energy Stew. I'm excited about talking with you further.
Thanks, Peter. I look forward to it.
And this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Stew at PRN.FM. I can reach at Peter at HeartRiver, HeartRiver.org, or 212-222-7748. I'd love to hear from you, and thank you so much for listening.